Okay, so what I thought we'd talk about today is a lecture I've entitled Phantom Akeda. The Akeda, of course, appears in this week's Parsha. It's one of those difficult stories in Tanakh. It seems like a fine enough story, except until you have children and you're telling them, have them on your knee right before bedtime and you're telling them Bible stories, and you get up to the Akeda and you're not quite sure what to do next. It just doesn't work as a very good bedtime story. As somebody who's reading bedtime stories to 5 and 10 year olds these days, I can tell you this from experience. How is it that we approach the Akeda? It's really a big issue, larger than this one talk. But I want to take a stab at a piece of that with you today. And I'd like to begin, if I can, by... by asking you this question. If you met somebody on a plane, my proverbial guy, Joe on the plane, the fellow who stopped studying Bible at McGill University, and just, he's going through the Bible, recognizes you as an Orthodox Jew, and says, I have all these questions, I'd love to run some questions by you. And then you try to find a different seat, but you're stuck for the rest of the flight with poor Joe. And you got to actually listen to his questions and find some way to respond to them. He starts talking about the Akeda. He wants to know, so tell me, what would you say? What would you say the Akeda is about? Right? It's described as a test. Avram is being tested. What exactly is he being tested about? What's the nature of the test? Right? What does it mean to pass? What does it mean to fail? What quality of his is he being tested by? What would you say? Anybody? Not a trick question. No? His amuna, you might say. Okay. So we have one vote for amuna. Right. So that says that God will test tzaddikim. But my question is, what is being tested? Okay, so you're again saying he's testing emunah. Okay, any other possibilities? What other quality are we testing? Yep. Okay, his value. How do you put it again? To see if he's correctly transmitted values to his son. Okay. Yeah. Obedience. Right. Okay. Any last stab? Yeah? Mercy. That would mean to see how merciful he is. So in other words, you're saying the test is, will he not go through with it? Right, perhaps. Okay? All right, so 1 second. All right, so we have a number of possibilities. The simplest possibility in the text, among the possible ideas which we have on the table, mercy, obedience, what else do we have? Amuna, right? See if we can trust in Hashem, transmit values to the next generation, something like that. The words of the angel, at least, are Yirei Elokim, Ata Yadati Ki Yirei Elokim Ata. Maybe it's Yiras Hashem. It's sort of hard to put your finger on exactly what quality is being tested. But simply put, I think in the very simple shot of the words, I think it has something to do with obedience. I mean, God says, go do this very difficult thing to do. Are you going to listen? Are you not going to listen? What I'd like to suggest today is there seems to be a different quality to this test than we might suspect. The test seems to be about something else, something surprising. When I say seems to be, I'm going to suggest to you that there is evidence from the text, if you look at the text carefully, that seems to suggest another surprising aspect to this test. And I think we don't often see it that way. So I want to see if we can uncover that today. What is this test about? What exactly is being tested? In order to do that, what I'd like to do is to make use of two, we'll call it literary devices, in reading through the pshat of the psukim here. And each of these devices is very powerful, and is powerful when used on their own, but when you use the two devices together, they become extremely powerful. This is not the only story where you can use these techniques. You can use them in many stories, at least 19 different stories throughout Sefer Bereishit, probably. But when you use them in tandem, they're very powerful. I'm going to take a minute to introduce the first of these techniques right now, and then I'll get to the second one in a few minutes when we use it. The first of these techniques is, there's an academic name for it, there's a not-so-fancy name for it. Academic name for this is intertextuality. The not-so-fancy name for this is, where have you heard these words before? Okay? Every once in a while, you'll be reading a story in Tanakh, and you'll come across a phrase, and the phrase will remind you of something. And you'll say to yourself, you know, gee, where have I heard these words before? That's a strange phrase. That phrase seems to resonate from another story that happened earlier. And then you keep on reading, and you find another phrase. And the second phrase, you say, gee, I've heard those words before too. And you look, and lo and behold, you seem to find them also in that very same parak, eight prakim earlier. And this happens again. You find a third phrase that reminds you of another phrase in that paragraph, and a fourth phrase. And at some point, you become convinced that this is not a coincidence. Maybe the first time was a coincidence. Maybe the second time was a coincidence. But at some point, when this happens 13, 14, 15 times, it just doesn't seem like a coincidence anymore. Now the question is, why is this happening? Well, that's true, but if it wasn't there, the fact that you read it before wouldn't mean anything. I could read Good Night Moon many, many times, and I wouldn't have this experience in reading Good Night Moon. Actually, you would. Good Night Moon, you keep on saying good night to the moon and to everything around. So you have heard those phrases before. But if you take an average book, right, Shakespeare's King Lear, anything like that, it's not the way modern literature gets laid out. So here's what seems to be going on. Let's go back to Joe on the plane for a minute. Give me a second. Joe on the plane comes to you and says, say, you know, you're an Orthodox Jew. You believe the Bible's deep, right? So you say, yes, of course, I believe the Bible's very deep. So you say, I got a question for you. This has always been bothering me. He says, how could the Bible be really deep? It's so short. So you say, well, what do you mean short? So he says, well, look at like the major stories in the Bible. Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. How long is it? It's 15 verses long. The Akedah, how long is it? It's another 15 verses long. The Tower of Babel, how long is that? 9 verses long. So you say, these are huge narratives in the history of mankind. I mean, if the Encyclopedia Britannica were writing about the Tower of Babel, it wouldn't be 9 sentences long. It would be 30 pages long. These are huge events. Now, the question is, how could you possibly hope to say anything, no matter how brilliant you are, how could you possibly hope to say something really deep in 9 sentences, in 15 sentences? Now, if somebody said to you, I'll give you this assignment, right now, take the next 10 minutes or 15 minutes, take as long as you want, and write 15 sentences that you think could be read with profit by people 3,000 years from now, right? But you only have 15 sentences. So now you could say, well, I couldn't do that. But could anyone do it? Is it even possible to do? How do you write something that's so short that is that deep? Right? This is Joe's problem. How would you explain this to Joe? What's going on? How would you? What's the answer to this question? Right? Is the Bible really deep? So some people say, when you ask them this, if you ask kids this in school, I've tried this actually. So one of the answers which I get a lot is, well, that's where the Mefarshim come in. Right? Now, is that a satisfying answer? Right? Why is that not a satisfying answer? Anybody? That's where the Mefarshim come in. Yes? They had to get it from somewhere, right? If it wasn't in the text, then they're like making it up, right? Or even if you say that's where tradition comes in. They got it from tradition. So then you're saying the Bible's not really deep. Tradition is deep, right? Is that what you're saying? So Torah Shebichtav, forget that. That's just like whatever. But like we have deep traditions or we have deep Mefarshim. But you can't have, if the deep Mefarshim again are analyzing the text, if they're digging in the text, and you say the deepness isn't in the text, it's only in the Mefarshim, what you're really saying is they made it up, Right? It's yeshma ayin, it's thin air. Do you really want to say that? Is that the answer to Joe? Some of the mafarshim aren't going to get you out of this. Right? It's really just a smokescreen. So what's really the answer to the question? So I think the answer to the question, one answer to the question, is there's got to be some way, some technique, which the Torah is using to, I'm going to say, layer meaning in the text. And what I mean by this, we're in Manhattan right now, right? So let's say you're a really rich guy in Manhattan, and you know, you don't like living in a one-bedroom studio apartment, but you're really rich and you only want to live in Manhattan. So what are you going to do? You want more space. Are there a lot of ranch houses to buy in Manhattan? You know, nice sprawling ranches with a horse farm, right? You aren't going to find this in Manhattan. So what can you do if you want space and you're not going to find the ranch house? How do you, if you're an architect, what do? You build up, right? So you have a multi-story apartment. That's what you have. You build up. So when space is at a premium, you build up. Well, in the Bible, space is at a premium. So maybe the architect in the sky, God, builds up. What does it mean to build up? What it means is that there are multiple stories, levels, to any story here with a, you know, the other kind of story. Multiple stories to every story. Or there's multiple layers, multiple levels to every story. Now, that sounds good, but what does that really mean? What does it mean to say there are different layers of meaning? We can talk about layers of meaning in a story, but what does it really mean to say that there's different layers of meaning in a story? So this gets back to this literary technique which I'm talking to you about. This is one literary technique which helps us perceive that is this idea of layering, which is to say that if you want to understand the Akedah, it's not just the Akedah that you have to understand. There's more than the Akedah. There are the phantom Akedahs, which is to say that every once in a while, the Torah will use this technique, intertextuality, where have you heard these words before, to create a layer, which is to say that, you know, one layer of meaning is here, there's another layer of meaning over here. I'll give you an example of what it is that I'm talking about so we can make this less abstract. Here's the example. Let's say you're reading let's say you're reading Bereishis, right? First pasuk of Bereishis. So, the world, aretz hayta tohu vavohu v'choshech al pnei tohum, ruach Elokim rachefet al pnei hamayim, right? So, you're reading that, and you play our little game. Where have we heard these words before? So where have we heard these words before? Where else in the Torah do we have a situation that this reminds you of? A situation where choshech al pnei tohum, there's darkness on the face of the deep. If you just closed your eyes, and you imagine what picture, what mind picture you have here. Just imagine this picture, right? That there is everything is chaotic. V'choshech al pnei tohum, darkness is upon the face of the deep. V'ruach Elokim merachefet al pnei hamayim, and there's this wind of God that's hovering over the face of the waters. What's the dominant element, right? It's water, water, water everywhere. Chaotic water, dark water, right? Storm-tossed water. What does this remind you of? Reminds you of the flood. So now, if it was just that, you'd say, all right, that's a coincidence, right? It just happens to remind you of the flood. That's no big deal. But it's not just that. So let's go to the story of the flood. If you open up to say, you don't have to do this, but you just listen to me if you want. But I think it's Perek Ches or so in Bereishis, where you get to the story of the flood. And you're reading, let's see where this is over here. And you're reading, and you have this pasuk, Vayizkar Elokim et Noach et kol ha'chayim ve'et kol ha'bema asher ito bateva, Vayaver Elokim ruach al aretz v'yashoko ha'mayim. Listen to these words carefully. Vayaver Elokim ruach al aretz. What do we have here? What does this remind you of? There's this sort of ruach, there's this wind or spirit of God that's blowing over what? The aretz. But what's the aretz now? It's just waters. Again, there's this wind of God hovering over the waters. Wind of God hovering over the waters. But then look at the next event. Vayisachru mainot tahom barubot ha-shamayim. Vayikalei ha-geshem min ha-shamayim. The next thing that happens is that the fountains of the deep get stopped up, right? And then also the rainwater goes back to the clouds. Barubot ha-shamayim. The storehouses of heaven get stopped up. So if you think about that, what does this remind you of back in Bereishit? What's the next event that happens in Bereishit after you hear about Tohu Vavohu? What's one of the first things that God does having to do with water? Yes? He separates between what? Between There is the upper waters and those lower waters. Now, I bet you never knew what the upper waters were, right? I mean, what are those upper waters? It's waters that's me'al rakia, waters that's above the rakia. But if you think about it in the comparison to Noah, it makes perfect sense, right? The lower waters would seem to be, you know, ma'inot tahom, these waters of the deep. And at least in Noah's terms, what are the upper waters? It's clouds, it's water vapor, and there's, and you know, when the sky is clear, so there's rakia b'toch ha'mayim, there's this blue sky, and then there's clouds above, and then there's waters below, and once again, the waters are separate. And then you keep on reading, and the next thing you have is v'tana chateva b'chodosh ha'shvi, al harei ararat, v'mayim hayu halof v'chasor, b'achad la'chodosh niru roshei ha'arim. What does this remind you of back in the beginning of Genesis? That the land begins to appear. Right? That's the next thing that happens back in Bereshit. Land begins to appear. God causes the waters to recede, and then Vatera Hayabashan. All of a sudden there's dry land. So now you have three events in order that you have back in the beginning of Bereshit that you hear echoes of after the flood. And that's not just those three events. The next events, it continues. Vayiftach Noach at Chalon HaTeva, and what does he do? He sends out the bird. And what does the bird come back with? So the bird bird comes back with the olive branch, with the branch, right? What does that tell Noah? There's vegetation in the world. Well, what gets created next? There's vegetation, right? And then the bird goes and the bird doesn't come back, and the world is different. There's a bird in the world now. It's the creation of birds, which is the next element back in Bereshit. And then Noah opens up the teva, and man and animal step out of the teva. What does this remind you of back in creation? It's the sixth day when the man and animal step out. And then God blesses Noah and the animals. What does he tell them? Pru urvu imulu ataretz, morach and dachitchem, yel kol chayat aretz. What does that remind you of? It reminds you of the blessing on the sixth day when God said, Pru urvu, be fruitful and multiply to man, v'kivshua, and conquer the land. So without getting this into too much detail, this is an example. What this is saying is that what the Torah seems to be saying is that if you want to understand Bereshit, you can't really understand Bereshit without understanding its second layer. There's a recreation. There's another story here. There's another creation story, which you sort of need to compare and to contrast. And these are layers. There's layer number one. There's layer number two. And to really understand the story, you have to be aware of the layers and kind of see how they relate to one another. The Torah is building up. The Akedah, next week's Parsha, is one of those stories which has a lot of layers. If you look at the Akedah, you will find that there are other Akedah stories scattered throughout Tanakh. More than one. We could do a whole series, I actually have done a series, on those different Akedah stories and those phantom Akedah stories, but today we're only going to talk about one of them, right? And try to understand how the second Akedah story changes our view of the first Akedah story. How does the new layer in the Akedah sort of change the way, alter the way, we look at the first Akedah? What is that other Akedah story? So the other Akedah story is, actually, it's the one that's closest there are a number of Akedah stories. Isha Shunamis and Malachim Beis is an Akedah story. Read through the story of the Isha Shunamis. It's not exactly the same as the Akedah. It's actually the reverse of the Akedah. But it's this woman going up the mountain, this woman who loses her child, woman who won't tell her spouse what's going on as she's leaving. And when the Isha Elohim comes down to her and says, you're going to have a child, what does she say? Right? Al tachazev b'shivchatecha, right? Lo tishaleh oti. Don't joke with me, right? What does that remind you of? It's Sarah, it's Yitzchak, it's another Akedah story. So we won't talk about that now. You can look at that in your own time and figure out what the meaning of the Isha Shunamit is in its relationship to the Akedah. What I want to talk to you about tonight, today, where are we up to today, is the story actually which is closest in proximity to the Akedah, which mirrors the Akedah. And that story takes place actually just a chapter earlier. Okay? The story actually, strangely enough, is the story of Girush Yishmael, another very difficult story to understand. It's the story of the expulsion of Yishmael. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to actually read through this story, and I want you to just think about this. I'm going to read through the story. And as I read through the story, I want you to be thinking Akedah, okay? And you're going to ask yourself, where have I heard this before? And whenever you get something that you've heard before, just sort of raise your hand or stand on top of your chair and start screaming, okay? That's what you need to do. So where have you heard this before? Where have you heard the Akedah before? What is this reminding you of in the Akedah? Okay, so the Akedah is in chapter 22. If you want, you can sort of follow along in the Akedah, but I'm going to be reading from the chapter before that, chapter 21. I will say, by the way, that what I'm saying, even though I'm saying it, you won't find this in other sources, but there are allusions to it, allusions with an A, not an I, in Chazal. So one of those allusions you'll find connecting these two stories in some of the very first Rashis in the Akedah. Right? Very familiar Rashis. If you think about this, the significance of what Rashi is saying, very strange Rashis at first value, at face value. But if you look at, for example, the very first Rashi in the Akedah, Vayhi achar dvar ma'ela, I think it's there. And it happened after these things. So Chazal wonder, what are those things? Yesh merobatenu omrim achar dvarav shel satan. After the words of the satan was mekatre. Shel yemekatre va'omer. The satan, Satan, was prosecuting Abraham, as it were. Va'omer mikol seuda she'asa Avram lo hikriv lefanecha par echad o ayil echad. From the entire meal that Avram made, he never offered any offerings to you. Now, what are the Chazal talking about? From the entire meal that Avram made. Which meal did Avram make? What's he referring to? A meal that Avram recently made. What meal? The meal that he made in celebration of Yitzchak's bris. That is the beginning of the Girush Yishmael story, right there. So in that meal, lo yigiv lefanecha par echad o ayil echad, he didn't give you anything, God. Amar lo, God responded to them, klum asa ela bishvil bano. That meal, what you're complaining about, Satan, why did he make that meal, Avram? He made that meal to celebrate the birth of his son. That son that he's celebrating, Ilu hayiti yomer lo zvach otel lefanai, if I would tell him to sacrifice that son, not a paro ayil, not another animal, but that son I would ask him to sacrifice, you'll see lo hayom ha'ake, if he would give me that son. That is the first Chazal. It's another Chazal that is bothered by the language of na. Kach na es bincha yichidcha. Right? Take, please, your only child. Why please? Why the Lashon Bakasha? So the Gemara says, I think Rashi quotes it, that it's like it's a mashal to a king that has a gibor, it's a mashal to a king that has a very strong, very strong warrior who always fights for him. And he says to him, look, you fought me a lot of wars, right? I want you to fight one last battle for me. And then Chazal says something strange. Why should you fight this last battle for me? Kadesh lo yomru is that people shouldn't say, Harishonos ein behem mamash. The first battles were nothing. So too, Avram, you did many battles on my behalf. There were 9 nisyonos that you passed, 9 tests that you passed. But I want you to pass one last test, the 10th pass. Kadesh lo yomru is that people shouldn't say, Harishonos ein behem mamash. The first ones were nothing. Now, I don't know about you, but to me, that's a strange Chazal. I mean, like, if you were Avram, and God said this to you, what would you say? You know, do me a favor. Take your child to the top of the mountain and kill him, because I know it's hard, but I know you've passed 9 tests. But it's just public relations. You know, I don't want people to say, have the wrong idea, to say that the first 9 were nothing. So do me a favor, just do this for me. What would you say? Would you be impressed? What do you say? You would say, excuse me, God, you know, you said I passed 9 tests, right? And you're confident that those work, right? Like, so for public relations, I should do this last test. Like, did I pass the test or didn't I pass the test? If I passed the test, we're done. If I, you know, like, what happened? So this is a very strange Chazal, but Chazal seemed to be saying there's something about the 9 tests, or maybe something about the 9th test, something about this that is, people can ask, people can say there's something, some issue with it. What is that 9th test? The 9th test is popularly assumed to be Girush Yishmael, the expulsion of Yishmael. These two Chazals seem to allude to a connection between these two events. Some connection between the story of the birth weaning Mila of Yitzchak and the subsequent expulsion of Yishmael and the Akedah. They are not just chronologically connected, but in the eyes of Chazal there is a thematic connection between them. What is that? I believe the evidence that Chazal had for this, I don't know if I'm going to get to explain all of that today, so I'm going to leave some of that as a mystery, but what I will say now is that Chazal weren't coming out of nowhere. They weren't making this up. There was strong evidence to suggest this. And the evidence is this kind of layering. So we're going to go through it right now. We're going to read through the story of Yerush Yishmael. And again, as I read through it, what is the evidence that these two stories are connected? All right, here we go. All right, first the introduction. V'Hashem pakad et Sarah kasher amar, v'yaz Hashem l'Sarah kasher diber. God gave Sarah the child. V'tar v'tel et Sarah l'Avram ben l'zkunav l'moed asher diber ato Elohim. So she has this child. V'yikra Avram Hashem b'no anolad lo asher yodol lo Sarah Yitzchak. Avram calls her Yitzchak. V'yomal Avram es Yitzchak b'no ben shemot asyam kasher tiva as Elohim. Yitzchak has Mila. Avram is 100 years old when this happens. Sarah said, tzichok asol yelokim kol ha-shamea yitzachakli. Sarah then says, God has made a laughter for me. Right? Anybody who hears this, now here's the first ambiguity. Translate these words in English, can you? Kol ha-shamea yitzachakli. How would you translate those words? Anybody who hears this, tzichok asol yelokim, God has made something laughable. Kol ha-shamea yitzachakli. What does it mean? Anybody? All right, you see we have two different answers from the crowd, right? The first answer is, will laugh with me. Because this seems to be the pashut shot. Pashut shot is Sarah's very joyful, she's very happy. Anybody who hears is going to laugh with me. This is very exciting, I have this child, right? The problem is that in Hebrew, that's not the way you would say it. Kol ha-shamea yitzachak li, how would you say laugh with me? Iti, you would say. But it doesn't say yitzachak iti. Kol ha-shamea yitzachak li. A literal translation of yitzachak li would be what? Will make fun of me, will laugh at me, will laugh to me, will laugh at me. I'm the object of their laughter. So whereas the context seems to suggest that Sarai is saying something nice, the literal meaning of the text seems to suggest something darker. That Sarai is almost saying people are going to make fun of her. Who could have possibly imagined that I would give birth to a child to Avram in his old age? Now look at the next pasuk. Avram makes this great party. And then all of a sudden, Sarah is ben Hagar Mitzris Ashel Yalda La Avram Mitzachek. All of a sudden, Sarah looks and sees that somebody's laughing. Just like she said. Or is it just like she said? Who's laughing? It's Hagar. Hagar's laughing. The question is, what kind of laughter? Is Hagar laughing with her? Right? What's that? I'm sorry, you're right. It's not Hagar. It's Ben Hagar. It's Yishmael. Yishmael is laughing. You're right. Yishmael is laughing. What kind of laughter? Right? Is he laughing with her? Apparently at her. How do you? And also, look at how he's described. We know Yishmael's name. If the Torah is interested in conserving space, how can you make the sentence a lot shorter? Vatera Sarah saw that someone was laughing. Who was laughing? Yishmael was laughing. So the great question is, why not just say, Yishmael was laughing? Why not call the person by name? Are you with me? Instead, we are euphemizing Yishmael. Who is Yishmael? Ben Hagar HaMitzris Asher Yalda LaAvram. That's a very long title for Yishmael. The child of Hagar who gave birth to Avram. Why is Torah calling him that? Well, notice how the Torah called Sarai. What did Sarai say? Why was Sarah so happy? Right? Because I gave birth to a child to Avram. Well, the appellation which we're giving to Yishmael, Ben Hagar HaMitzris Asher Yalda LaAvram, seemingly explains the reason why he's laughing. Why is he laughing? He's laughing right after an event. The event is a feast. Right? Yishmael looks at the feast and laughs. What's Yishmael's perspective on this feast? I don't remember anything like this when I was born. Right? You know? What's going on over here, right? And, of course, who is he? I am also the child of a mother who gave birth to Avram. But where's the feast? So he directs that animosity towards laughter. Laughter is always the great cover-up for animosity. And directs it towards Sarai. And lo and behold, what Sarai had half predicted happens. Sarai, of course, had hoped that people would laugh with her, but there was that sense that people might laugh at her, and all of a sudden, there's someone laughing at her. And, Vatomer la'Avram, Gareshes ha'amazos, vesbanah. And she says, expel this woman, this servant and her child, kilo yirash ben amazos, im b'ni im yitzchak. And now we get to a very difficult story. Vayera davar ma'od b'nei Avram. Avram didn't like this. Now I'm going to go back to Joe on the plane. You all know this story. Here's my Joe on the plane question for you. Avram didn't like this. He thought it was a bad idea. But ultimately, Avram complies. He asks God, and God says, no, you have to do it. You have to listen to Sarah. Okay. So he goes and he does it. But look what happens at the end of the story. What does he do? He sends her off with what? If you read the text, Vayikach lechem v'chemat mayim. He sends her off with a loaf of bread and a canteen. You with me? And they're off in the desert. And then what happens? The canteen gets used up. And the loaf of bread gets used up, apparently. And there's this woman in the hot desert, and she's starving. And her child is dying of thirst. And, of course, Joe on the plane's question is going to be what? What was he doing? How could he do this? This is Avram the Baal Chesed. Now, okay, fine. So he had to give in. So he had to send her away. You with me? So he had to send her away. So if you were Avram, how would you send her away? What would you do? I mean, you'd at least send her away with a guide. That's the way the next city, right? You know, and you'd send her with 15 camels worth of provisions to make sure that she has enough food. But look what happens. Couldn't he have predicted this? Couldn't he have seen what was going to happen? Joe is very upset. You're the representative of Orthodox Judaism. What do you have to say to Joe? What is going on? How could Avram do this? This is a very problematic issue, right? What's going on? I think the layers in the story address this issue too. So we're going to get back to this issue. In the meantime, let's put this issue on hold and come back and look at the layers of the story. Now is the beginning of where we begin to see the layers. I'm going to skip to Pasuk Yud Dalet. Okay, now you get your antenna up. Where have you heard Akedah before? Vayashkem Avram Baboker. Avram wakes up in the morning, right? I don't see anybody standing on the top of their streets and screaming, right? Okay, there we go. What do we have? Akedah, right? That's the way the Akedah begins too, with Avram waking up in the morning. So both stories begin with Avram waking up in the morning. If it was only that, you'd say it's a coincidence. But it's not only that. Vayashkem Avram Baboker. So then Vayikach Lechem V'chemas Mayim. So he takes his the canteen and all that. But Yitenal Agar Samal Shifma, and he places it on, Hagar puts it on her shoulder, Vesayeled, and the child, Vishalcheha, and sends her away. Vatelach Vatesa B'midbar Be'er Sheva. And then she goes and she wanders. He sends her away and she goes and she gets lost. And she wanders in the desert in Be'er Sheva. There we go. Good. Be'er Sheva happens to be a place that reappears in the Akedah at the end of the Akedah. That's where Avram goes to at the end of the Akedah. That's where Avram's coming from, or that's where Hagar is in the beginning of the story. Yes? Okay, good. I hadn't thought of that, but that's a good point also, which is that Avram actually on his journey doesn't know where he's going. God specifically keeps the destination hidden. Notice also that Avram, as I said before, doesn't give her a guide. Here's the way to the next city. And in fact, she gets lost. So she also is going without a destination in mind, except that she doesn't have God appearing and guiding her. Yeah? Okay, good. That's true. That's in Chazal. I wasn't going to get to that. But there are Eov echoes as well in the Chazal. Not in the text, but in the Chazal. Where else do we have a story where the Satan comes out of the blue and says to God, I don't like what's going on. What's going on with this guy? And God defends him and says, what do you mean? He's perfect. It's Eov. The Chazal seem to be using the language of Eov somehow to describe what's happening in heaven. Where do Chazal get that from? That is beyond the scope of this talk. But if you want to research that, the place to look would be Eov. If you look at the first perek in Eov, look at all the connections you find between that perek and the Avram story. You'll find an abundance of them. It seems to be the evidence that Chazal had. But let's not get into that. Let's stay focused for a second. All right, so we're back in this story. We're looking for connections to the Akedah. We found a few. Let's continue. Vayichlu amayim min achemet. We're up to Perek Pasuk Tes Vav. So the water gets used up. Vatashlech hasayela tachas achad hasichim. And then she casts the child underneath one of the bushes. All right? Anybody? What is this? Okay, so you might say it's the aisle. Maybe. Could be. There's the aisle caught in the bushes. It was caught in the bushes. There's bushes in both cases. But I think there's a stronger connection. Yeah? Oh, very good. Okay, good. Yeah. So if you actually look at the Akedah story, you'll notice that there is this point in the Akedah where seemingly superfluous possible, which is that as they're going up the mountain, what does Avram do? The Yosem Esayitzim, he takes the wood, right, and he places it al Yitzchak Beno, on top of his child. So if you think of that image, you have wood on top of child. Where in Girush Yishmael do you have wood on top of child? Well, right over here, branches on top of child. Vatashlechas Hayeled, Tachas Acharasichim. When she casts the child under the bramble branches, again, branches on top of child. So far we have Avram waking up in the morning, we have Be'er Sheva, we have her going to a place where she doesn't know where she's going, and we have branches on top of child. Right? Maybe it could still be a coincidence. But let's keep on going. So Vatelech Vatashabla Mineged Harche Kintachave Keshes. Such a strange description, wouldn't you say? She goes and she sits herself far away, about as far as you could shoot a bow. About a bow shot away, as far as you could shoot an arrow. That's a pretty vivid description. Strange that the Torah would use that one. Ki amra, because she says to herself, Al era b'mot hayeled, let me not see the death of the child. Vatashav mineged, and she sits far away, Batisa es kolah vatev, and she raises her voice and she cries. But then God hears the voice of the child. And the angel of God calls out to Hagar from the heavens. Come on, guys, you're not paying attention. All of your hands should be raised. Where do you have that? That's the Akedah. As a matter of fact, believe it or not, you would think the Torah would be full of angels calling out min hashamayim. These are the only two places in Chumash that you have this. The angel calling out from heaven to a person in this language, it's here and the Akedah. The angel calling out from heaven. A fifth element that reminds us of the Akedah. But now the question is, what does the angel say? Is there anything about what the angel says that reminds you of what the angel says to Avram? So let's keep on reading. Vayomer lo, and now this is a little double entendre. Vayikra malach Elokim min hashamayim, a malach of God calls out from the heavens and says, Vayomer lo, ma lo Hagar. You get it there? You hear that little double entendre? The malach calls to Hagar and says, ma lo Hagar. You got that? Right? You got it? Okay. Right? What's with you, Hagar? Right? Al tir'i ki shama Elokim et kol hanar. Anybody? Do not be afraid because God has heard the voice of the child. What does this remind you of in the Akedah? Do not be afraid. The angel, this is the opposite, the exact opposite of the Akedah. In the Akedah, right, there was also fear that the angel talked about. The angel said, Ata yadati kirei Elokim ata. Now I know that you fear God. This angel is saying the opposite, which is, do not fear, right? Don't fear, not having to do with God, but do not fear Hagar, yes? I didn't hear you? Okay, we're going to get to that. I deliberately left that out, but you're right. So we'll come back to that in a minute. Al tiri ki shama Elokim et kol hanar b'asher husham. So do not be afraid, right? God has heard you. Okay, now let's keep on reading what the angel is saying. So far we have six connections. Let's go further. As the angel is talking, do we hear anything else that reminds us of the Akedah? Kumi, get up. Si'i et hanar v'chazi'i et yadech bo. Lift up the child, v'chazikiyat yadechbo, and hold his hand, ki l'goy gadol asimenu, because I will make him into a great nation. Anybody? Yeah? What? Okay, first of all, Yitzchak also has the bracha that he's going to be made into a great nation, and now Yishmael has the bracha that he's going to be made into a great nation. But it's more than that. There's another opposite connection. Just like fear was opposite, Avram has said, fear God, I know you're a fear of God. Hagar is told, do not fear. There's another opposite connection. Let's see if you can find it. Kumi si'i et hanar v'chaziki et yadechbo. Go, lift up the child and hold his hand. There you go. Hagar is being told to benevolently reach out her hand and make contact with her child, physical contact with her child. What does the angel tell Avram? The exact opposite. Do not make physical contact with your hand. Al tishlach yadcha lanar. Don't stretch out your hand to touch the child. Not benevolent contact, but malevolent contact. Do you understand how they're opposites? Hagar is told, go make benevolent physical contact with your hand to the child. The angel's telling Abram, go do not make malevolent physical contact to the child. Exact opposites, mirror images in what the angel is saying. Seven connections between the stories. Eight connections in the stories. And here's a ninth. Vayifkach Elokim et Eineha. And then God opens her eyes. Vatera be'Ermayim. And all of a sudden she sees this well. What does this remind you of? Avram also opens his eyes and sees, and there's this lamb. In both cases, there's this life-saving possibility, an alternative korban, a well which can bring someone back to life. So she fills up the canteen, right? Vayihi Elokim et Hanar, vayigdal, vayashav b'midbar. Vayihi Ravak Hashet, we'll come back to that. Vayashav b'midbar Paran, and he settles in the wilderness of Paran. Vatigach lo imo isha me'eretz Mitzrayim, a tenth connection. Anyone? And his mother takes a wife from him from Eretz Mitzrayim. Immediately after the Akedah, what's the next event that happens? Right after the Akedah, we have Chaya Sara. What's Avram preoccupied with? A wife for Yitzchak. And what is Hagar preoccupied with? A wife for Avram. What? A wife, excuse me, from Yitzchak. And a wife from where? A wife from specifically the homeland. The homeland for Hagar is Mitzrayim. The homeland for Avram is back to Haran. So in both cases, not a wife from here, but a wife from the homeland. And in a way, what this signifies is the independence of Yishmael, or the break from Avram's household, right? Who's in charge now, right? Who's the parent now? The parent is exclusively Hagar, and she's going to find a wife from her neck of the woods. Okay, 10 connections. It can't be coincidental. Any one or two of them, maybe. 10 connections? I don't think so. The stories are connected. Why are the stories connected? All right, and here's where we get... I didn't hear you. What was that? Yeah, what's that? Yeah, okay, could be. That's true. Did I miss anything? Maybe I missed something? What? Yeah. Yes, that's true. Another indication that Chazal saw a connection between them. Both of these are read on Rosh Hashanah. Didn't it always bother you, like, if we had to have a reading on Rosh Hashanah, so the Akedah maybe, right? But why is it that we're reading about Girish Yishmael on Rosh Hashanah? Why are we reading? Maybe the answer is, if you really want to understand the Akedah, you can't understand the Akedah without also understanding Girish Yishmael. Girish Yishmael is part and parcel of the story, the expulsion of Yishmael. How would that be so? So now we have to figure out why. What does it all mean? Okay, so now let me introduce to you, I mentioned to you we were going to make use of two literary techniques. The first literary technique we've talked about, intertextuality, where we heard these words before. Now it's time for the second literary technique. The second literary technique is something known as chiasm. Some of you may be familiar with this, some of you might not be familiar with it. I don't know how you pronounce it. Some pronounce it as chiasm, some pronounce it as chiasms, but that's the literary name for it. It comes from the Greek letter chi, which is like an X. And the not-so-fancy name for it that we would have in Judaism is an atbash pattern. Atbash. What is atbash? So most of you are familiar with atbash to the extent that you are, as sort of a Kabbalistic device that has to do with numerology or letters. The idea that at some level, aleph, the first letter of the mirror of the alphabet, mirrors the last letter of the alphabet, tav. Beit, the second to first letter. Atbash, correct. Beit, the second to first letter, mirrors Shin, the second to last letter, and so on. It turns out that Atbash patterns, it is widely becoming recognized, don't just appear in the Aleph phase, but they appear widely and thoroughly, ubiquitously, throughout Tanakh. It seems to be a favored literary device which is used by the Chumash. Why are chiasms used? That's a good question. I don't know. I can't tell you why. I have my theories. My theory is, that an atbash pattern is an incredibly elegant way to give you a lot of information all at once. Getting back to Joe on the Plains question, which is that how do you say something deep in 9 sentences, an atbash pattern is a great way to say something deep in 9 sentences. Look at the opportunity. An atbash pattern will mean that in any given section of text, you may find that the first sentence of the text mirrors the last sentence of the text. The second to first element of the text mirrors the second to last element. The third to first mirrors the third to last. Why do things this way? What do you do? Well, first of all, what does this remind you of, right? What's happening here? You have a progression leading inexorably towards what? Towards the center. Do you understand? Every Atbash pattern is leading you towards the center. That's very important, because what the Torah is doing then in an Atbash pattern, it's defining the center of the text for you, which is not always the geographic center. Do you understand? You could have 10 psukim, the center is not always in pasuk number 5. Right? It could be anywhere that the Atbash pattern leads you. And what the Torah is saying is, what are you going to find at the center? Right? What are you going to find at the center? You're going to find something central, right? You're going to find a center of gravity that everything revolves around. So isn't that amazing? I mean, when we think, we talked before, where do you find the depth? Mefarshim. Right? That's nice. But what if the Torah is its own Mefarish? Wouldn't that be cool? Right? I mean, what if the Torah has its own commentary, which is inlaid into the Torah, teaching you how to read a text? Right? Intertextuality, where we heard these words before, is one element of that commentary. But another element of that commentary is that the Torah is going to tell you what the center of gravity is, what everything revolves around. If you knew that, wouldn't you pay something for that? I mean, that's worth something. In a given text, you know what the Torah itself thinks is the center, what it's all about. It's this pasuk that all revolves around. That's a big deal. Plus, on the way there, you can see how each of the pairs in the chiasmus play off of each other, which can also teach you something, but that's another source. Chiasmus also teaches you other things which are probably more complicated than this, but let's kind of leave it there for that. I think I just dropped an MP3 player. I did, and it scattered its batteries all over the place, but it looks like there's another backup one, so we'll go with that for now. Okay, turns out that the Akedah seems to be built like this. The Akedah seems to be built chiastically. Built in an Atbash pattern. It's actually a very complicated Atbash pattern, but to keep it simple, we don't have a lot of time, let's just isolate a couple elements of it. One of the easiest ways to see it is with Vayelchu Shneim Yachdav. You've probably noticed that in the Akedah, the phrase Vayelchu Shneim Yachdav, and they walk together, Avram and Yitzchak walk together, appears more than once. It appears twice, right? That's one element of this chiastic structure, right? Vayelchu Shneim Yachdav at the beginning of the story, Vayelchu Shneim Yachdav at the end of the story. Even at the beginning of the story, by the way, going back to the way beginning of the story, God calls out to Avram and says, and Avram answers, Hineni, right? Well, there's another time that God called, that an angel of God, right, at the end of the story calls out to Avram. And Avram also answers Hineni, the Hineni at the beginning of the story, the Hineni at the end of the story. The Vayelchu Shneim Yachdav towards the beginning of the story, the Vayelchu Shneim Yachdav towards the end of the story. Now, what happens, let's actually go to the Akedah for a second, see if we can find that. Look right before the first Vayelchu Shneim Yachdav. Vayikach Avram es Atzei Olah. This is right before the first Vayelchu Shneim Yachdav. Right before the first Vayelchu Shneim Yachdav, Avram takes the wood for the offering, and what does he do? Vayosim al Yitzchak Beno. He places it on Yitzchak's shoulders, going up the mountain. You with me? Now I want you to think about that for a moment. If you were Avram placing wood on top of Yitzchak's shoulders to go up the offering, to go up the mountain, what would you have to do in order to make sure that the wood wouldn't slip off of his back? You'd have to tie it. So what we have is tied up wood on top of Yitzchak right before Vayelchu Shneim Yachdav. Now look at the second Vayelchu Shneim Yachdav. Right after the second Vayelchu Shneim Yachdav, what do we have? Anything that reminds you of tied up wood on top of Yitzchak? You have tied up Yitzchak on top of wood. Right? Are you with me? Avram takes Yitzchak and ties him up on top of the wood. Do you understand? Right? You understand? Hineni, tied up wood on top of Yitzchak, and they walk together, and then they walk together, tied up Yitzchak on top of wood, Hineni. That's an Atbash pattern. You with me? Now let's keep on going, because we want to identify what the center is. The center is going to lie where? In between what? In between, right, the two Vayelchu Shneim Yachdavs, right? That's the innermost elements which we have so far. What's in between the two Vayelchu Shneim Yachdavs? turns out that a conversation is there. A conversation between Yitzhak and Avram. Now it's interesting because the conversation seems to be about small talk. But think about this. How many conversations between Yitzhak and Avram do you know about in Chumash? Only one. In all of Chumash, we only know of one conversation that Yitzhak and Avram ever said, and it's right here in the center of the Akedah. Must be a pretty important conversation. So let's look at the conversation and see what we find. By the way, now get to the Rashis. Right? The Rashis mean something. The Rashis at the beginning, what's Rashi's explanation of the two Vayelfu Shneim Yachdas? How come there's two of them? Right? Remember what Rashi says? Rashi says that the same way that they were together before the conversation, they were together after the conversation. Right? What's the difference before this conversation and after the conversation? What happens in the conversation? Yitzchak finds out. Right? Now if you think about it, right, that's a big deal. The same togetherness that they had going up the mountain, they have going down the mountain. They have after the conversation too. It's an amazing thing. Let's keep on reading. Let's read the conversation and see what we find. Here's the conversation. Vayomer Yitzchak, now let's read this carefully. What are the extra words here? Vayomer Yitzchak el Avram Aviv, Vayomer Avi. Let's translate. And Yitzchak said to Avram his father, and he said, quote, Father. What's strange about this? Anything? Vayomer Yitzchak el Avram Aviv, Vayomer, quote, Avi. What are the extra words? Okay, so first of all, if you don't know by now that Avram is Yitzchak's father, right, you haven't been paying attention. So it didn't have to say that Yitzchak called out to Avram his father. It could have just said Yitzchak called out to Avram, you'd have figured it out. That's one thing. But the second thing is, there's an extra Vayomer here. Do you get it? Yeah, just listen. Vayomer Yitzchak al Avram Avi, Vayomer hi Avi. It's not even grammatical. Do you understand? Vayomer, and Yitzchak said to Avram, what do you want to know? And Yitzchak said to Avram his father, and he said, quote, Father. What's the question which is lurking in your mind? But he didn't say anything the first time. What did he say the first time? Like, why did you say he said, and then you didn't tell me what he said? Do you understand? In English, you can't say the word said without saying what someone said. You could say spoke. I could say I spoke to you, and that's a complete sentence, we're done. But if I say I said to you, you need to understand what I said. Right? You can say Vayadaber spoke, and that's fine. But you can't say said. Vayomer Yitzchak al Avram Aviv. What did he say? And then Vayomer, and then he said. But what did he say the first time? Why the two saids here? So my Rosh Hashiva, Rav Yaakov Weinberg, actually had his interpretation of this is, and he's find this often, by the way, in a Chumash, this double Vayomer. So whenever you have something like this, the Torah is telling you something. In this case, it's the Torah will takes a no-hold-barred approach to meaning. Sometimes it will even break the rules in order to hit you over the head with something. Here we're breaking grammatical rules. What does that breakage of grammatical rules mean? There's a non-sequitur going on. What it means is that there were two conversations. Yitzchak, like, opened his mouth to say something, and then before he could even say it, he said something else. And the something else was one word, Avi. My father. What does that mean? That changes everything. What that means is that Avram and Yitzchak were in conversation going up the mountain. What were they talking about? It doesn't matter what they were talking about. They were talking about the weather. They were talking about how muddy the tracks were. They were talking about whatever it was. And all of a sudden, Yitzchak stops. He stops that conversation. And he's about to say something. And there's this interruption. And instead, Vayomer, he says something else. And the one thing he says is, my father. Now stop. You're Avram. If you're Avram, what do you feel now? You feel a dagger to your heart. Those words, that one word, how you wished he didn't say that one word, right? That word, my father, is the word you've been avoiding the whole time up the mountain. Because what does that word mean, my father? What is that? Why are you avoiding that word? What's the one obligation, the most basic obligation that a father has towards a son? Protection, right? And now he's calling out to me, reminding me of it. What do you want to do when you hear that word from Yitzchak? You want to die. You want to run right down the mountain, right? You will either run emotionally or you run physically. To run physically means you leave. To run emotionally means, let's not talk about that. Let's go back to the weather. So, what do you think about the muddiness of the path, right? I hear they're predicting rain for tomorrow, right? Something like this. You do not want to focus on this because you know that Yitzchak doesn't know something, which you know, and you haven't been talking about it. And when he stops, and he prefaces that with that one word, it's the last word that you want to hear. Let's keep on reading. So then we get to Avram's response. Vayomer hineni b'ni. This is Avram's greatness. I am right here, Rashi. Right? Lashon Achana, Lashon Ziris, I am ready. I am right here. I am right here for you. Hineni b'ni. The last place Avram wants to be right now is here, both emotionally and physically. I'm here. I am your father. I know I'm your father. Right? Talk to me. I'm right here for you. What do you want to know? And then Yitzchak asks the question. Vayomer, hine ayesh v'yitzim. Dad, I see the fire. I see the wood. But what's with the seh? Where is the lamb? Now, when Yitzchak says this, he uses a particular word for where, which is ayeh. It's not the only word for where in Hebrew. We also have epho. What's the difference between epho and ayeh? Talk about this in my book. Epho seems to be, if you look at all the ephos in Tanakh, a regular request for where, a request for location. If you look at the ayehs in Chumash, including the ayeh to Cain, the ayeh to Adam Arishon, right? When God says, Ayeka, where are you? It's God talking. He knows where he is. Why is he asking a question he already knows the answer to? The answer is, ayeh is not asking where something is. Ayeh is asking something else. It's asking why something isn't where you expected it to be. What happened to X? Where is X? Ayeh HaKadesha Be'enayim, the messenger of Yehuda says about the harlot who used to be the side of the road. Where did she go? What happened to her? How come she isn't here? So too over here. Yitzchak isn't asking, so Dad, where did we leave the set? Was it by the barn or maybe it was by the shed? Like, where was that set? That's not the question. The question is, Ayeh HaSelola. There's no set. What happened to the set? How come there's no set? There's supposed to be a set here. There's no set. That's an entirely different question. That's what's going on, right? Yitzchak knows. Now, what does Avram respond? Here's Avram's response. Vayomer Avram, Elokim yir elo haselo olav benim, vayachus neim yachdav. There is an ambiguity in Avram's answer. The ambiguity depends on where you put the comma. It's an interesting book, right? Eats, Shoots, and Leaves. I don't know if you're familiar with it. Great book, right? On grammar, and specifically commas, how a comma can change the meaning of a sentence. Here, too, the comma changes the meaning of the sentence. There's two ways to read the sentence. One is, Elokim yir elo haselo ola, comma, b'ni. Then it means, God will show himself a lamb for the offering, comma, my son. But there's another way to read it, without the comma. Without the comma is, maybe you're the lamb for the offering, my son. It's an entire different meaning. Why is there this ambiguity? Why doesn't Avram just say what he means? I would argue, and this is only speculation, that Avram is saying what he means. One of the problems we have with the Akedah, with reading the Akedah, is you already know the end, because you get to read the end. But guess what? Avram didn't get to read the end. When he goes through this, he doesn't know the end. So he is being as honest as he possibly can be. He does not know what is going to happen at the top of this mountain. Nothing makes any sense. God has told him to go and sacrifice the only son that he has, the son that he says is going to be the son that is going to carry on his legacy, and take him and kill him at the top of the mountain. Does that make any sense? No. But he's going to do it anyway, because that's what God said. What's going to happen at the top of the mountain? The honest truth is, he just doesn't know. Right? God's going to figure it out. Elohim Yirelo Asel. I don't know, one way or the other. God's going to find for himself a lamb. Will you be the lamb? Could be. Will God find another lamb? Could be. I can't play God. But I know one thing. I know that's up to God. It's not up to me. So God's going to figure that one out. Avram's greatness, I think, lies right here in this conversation. There are five Vayomers in this conversation. Five exchanges between Avram and Yitzchak in this conversation. This conversation is at the center of a chiasm. What's at the center of this conversation? What's at the center of this conversation is the central element in the Akedah. There are five elements to the conversation. If there's five elements, which element is central? The third. What's the third Vayomer? Hineni Bani. That's the middle. The Akedah begins with Hineni. The Akedah ends with Hineni. And right there in the middle is a Hineni. It begins with Hineni to God. It ends with Hineni to the angel. Those two Hinenis are opposites. Because the first Hineni is, I'm here, ready to do whatever you ask, no matter how hard it is. The last Hineni is the very opposite of that. It's the angel pulling him back at the last possible minute and saying, don't do it. And Avram saying Hineni to that. Do you remember the Rashi there? Strange Rashi. Rashi says that Avram bargained with the angel. Avram said to the angel, I'm here already. Can't I just make a little cut? Can't I just take a little bit of blood? And the angel said, no, not just al tash lechadcha, al tash lo muma. Don't touch him at all. Not even just a little cut. What are Chazal talking about? Are they mad? Avram wants to make a little cut, and Yitzchak, he loves Yitzchak. The answer is, if you're Avram, do you know what it takes to get yourself in a psychological frame of mind where you could do this? Where you are ready to fulfill the word of God and to kill your child? You're like a freight train at that moment. You're focused on the only thing I can do is this. And when the angel says no, at the very last minute, it's even hard to listen to that. But Avram's greatness is he is able to listen to that. But there's a third piece that he balances it with. It's one thing to have fealty for God. It's another thing to answer Hineni to the angel. But it's a third thing entirely to answer Hineni to your child. That's the middle of the Akedah. That's what it's all about. Avram's greatness seems to be his ability to balance his fealty to God with fealty to the child when those two are trains going on two different tracks. Avram is the guy standing on top of the train with one foot on this train, one foot on that train, with the tracks slowly diverging. What do you do? What's Avram's answer? And that's where Avram's emunah comes in. Avram's faith comes in. And that is why it's a test of faith. Avram couldn't have done it without faith. What Avram says is, I have two obligations, both of which are absolute. I have an obligation towards God to be there for him. I also have an obligation towards my child to be there for him. So even though it is psychologically difficult, I am here, I love you, I am here, and I am honest with you, and I tell you lovingly everything that I can tell you, and I don't know, and there is the faith. God is a big boy. God is loving. He's up there in the heavens. He is going to figure it out. And whatever happens up there, God is going to figure out. But I can't do that. That's not up to me. And until then, I will say Hineni to God, and I will say Hineni to my child, and I will do that for as long as I possibly can. And you will come to me and say, Avram, are you crazy? Look where you're going at the top of the mountain. You're going to have to make a choice. You're not going to be able to do both. And Avram says, that's not up to me. That's up to God. For as long as I can, I am right here. I know what I can do, and I know what God can do. I know what I have to do, and what I have to do is to be there for Yitzchak too, to be there for God for as long as I possibly can. And that is Avram's greatness. It's right there at the center of the Akedah. I'm running out of time. I'll try to conclude in the last 5 minutes, but let's get back to Girush Yishmael. There was a voice from that table over there which noticed another connection between the stories. That's right. Another connection between the two stories is that there's a conversation which Hagar has in that story too that mirrors the conversation that Avram has with Yitzchak. Mirrors, not the same, but is a mirror image of. Do you remember how the story with Avram of the conversation is bracketed by Vayelchu Shneim Yachdav on top and on the bottom, and in the middle there's a conversation. With Hagar 2, there's a phrase before the conversation and a phrase after the conversation. And those phrases are this. When Hagar sees that the child is in trouble, what does she do? Let's go back to the text. Pasuk Tesvav. I'm sorry. Pasuk Teszayin. Here's the verses. Vatelech batashav la mineged. And she stood from afar. Harchek kimetachave keshes. About as far as you can shoot a bow. Ki amra, because she said to herself, al era b'mot hayeled. I will not see the death of the child. Batashav mineged. And then she stood from afar. Did you hear that? The second, and she stood from afar. Hagar stands from afar once, and stands from afar again. What happens in between the two stands from afar? First of all, think about Vayelfushneim Yachdav and its relationship to, and she stood from afar. How do those relate? They're exact opposites. Vayelfushneim Yachdav, you're walking, and you're walking with the child. Where is Hagar? She's not walking, she's standing. And where is she standing? She's standing away from the child, far away from the child, about a bow shot away. Now, in between those two Vatelech Vatashav Laminegets, is there a conversation? Listen carefully and tell me if there's a conversation. Vatelech Vatashav Laminegets, there's the first one, and she stands from afar. Harchek Kimetachavei Keshes, about a bow shot away. Ki Amra, because she said, Al Ere B'mot HaYelet, I cannot see the death of the child. Vatashav Laminegets, there's the second one, and she stood from afar. Is there a conversation? The answer is yes, but not with her child. Her child's far away. It's a conversation that Hagar has with herself. Instead of a conversation with the child, Hagar is talking to herself. And what does she say? If you look carefully, it's an exact mirror image of what Avram says to Yitzchak. Avram said, Elokim yira lo haselo la bani. That word yira, God will show himself, right, will show for himself a lamb for the offering. I don't know. It's not up to me. But there's a God in heaven. God's going to show himself a land for the offering. If you think about Avram, Avram is in very close to a position of Hagar right now. Both stories are about a parent witnessing a near-death episode of a child. Now, if you're a parent, if you're witnessing the death of your child, Rachman Litzlan, right, what is happening? You have competing urges going inside you, right? One urge is saying, I can't watch this. I can't see this. What if there was nothing you could do? What if there was nothing you could do? What would you do? One part of you would say, I can't watch it. But what would the other part of you say? I am here for you. It doesn't matter whether I can do anything. I am here for you. I have to be here with you. Right? Hagar, batelech batashav la mineged, she stands far away. Harchek kimetachavei keshes, about a bow shot away. Kiyamra al ere b'mot hayeled, I cannot see the death of my child. Avram said, God will see for himself a lamb. Hagar says she can't see. She can't see the death of her child. Batisad kolah vateif, and she lifts up her voice and she cries. Whenever you have batisad kolah vateif in Chumash or in Tanakh, it always seems to exude a loss of hope. A complete sense of yush. There's no point in going on anymore. I'm completely broken. And then God hears, but he doesn't hear her. Vayishma Elokim et kol anar. It's strange, because the child didn't say anything, and yet God is listening to the child, not her. And the Malach comes out, and the Malach comes out of the heavens, and says, what's with you, Hagar? Malach Hagar. Al tiri, the opposite of Avram, don't be afraid. God has heard the voice of the child. Pick him up. Hold his hand. Why is the angel playing psychologist? Go hold his hand. Why is it so important? Because kilo goy gadolatzimeno. He's going to be a great nation. What if you don't hold his hand? What then? What does Ishmael grow up to be? An archer. Why of all things an archer? How far away was his mother? About as far as you could shoot a bow. Such a strange language. Why does Yishmael become an archer if his mother was about as far as you could shoot an arrow? And Yishmael is always shooting arrows. Because when he was dying and his mother was far away and he was crying out and the only one who listened was the angel because his mother wasn't there. And then later on, this is the child who laughed. This is the child who laughed at Sarah in defense of his mother's dignity. Because my mother also gave birth to Avram, a child who loves his mother. But she wasn't there when I felt like I was dying. And he becomes an archer. He's trying to do one of two things. Either he's shooting bows because she was a bow shot away to bridge the distance between him and her. Or alternatively, he's trying to kill her. Or maybe both. If you think about children whose parents leave them, if you go to a foster home and you talk to kids, I once had a conversation with a worker at a foster home. She said there was this one girl who every night would go to sleep and she would scream and she would say, "I hate my mother. I hate my mother. I hate my mother." And then she would cry and she would say, "But I love my mother. I love my mother." And you can't, and you have both of those. So Yishmael picks up the bow. Violence is the only way to either reach his mother or express his animosity with his mother or both at the same time. And this is Yishmael. The two stories are connected. One story is an Akedah, the other story is a failed Akedah. But the meaning of the Akedah itself is not quite what we think it is. It's not just a blind test of faith in God. It's not just, will you do everything for God? It's much more subtle than that. It's, will you do everything for God, and what of your relationship with your child? Will you be able to balance these two when they seem to be competing? And Avram's success is in that he was able to succeed where Hagar did not succeed. I regret that I didn't have time, out of time, to get in, to answer my other questions. I really shouldn't have left you with them if I wasn't going to answer them. But the other questions about what Avram was doing, right? But I'll leave you just with a thought of what he was doing. Was Avram really, really so mean, right? What was he doing? He was really so mean. He sent this woman off with nothing but a piece of bread and a little bit of water. That's right. If you look carefully, Sarai said, "Garesh et ha'amazos." Expel that woman. When Avram does it, after a discussion with God, if you look at the verb, it's not vayigarsheha. Instead, he takes a piece of bread and some water, and it's not vayigarsheha, vayishalcheha. What's the difference between vayishalcheha and vayigarsheha? Vayigarsheha is to expel. What does vayishalcheha mean? To send. Which is harsher? To expel. Vayishalcheha, when you send someone, what possibility is there always? They might come back. Hagar had run away once before. Avram just sends her away. He fulfills the letter of the law, right? Send him away. But he gave her just a canteen of water and just a loaf of bread. What message do you give when you send someone in the desert with no direction, with just a canteen of water and just a little bit of bread? What are you saying to them? When you're done with it, come back. There's only one problem. Vatelech batesa bamidbar beresheva. She got lost. That wasn't what he was banking on. Avram unwittingly plunged Hagar into an Akedah-like situation that she wasn't ready for. She got lost. God had the last say. No, she's going to leave. Right? God made it happen the way he was going to make it happen. But because he only sent her with a cup of water, right? Look what happened to her. She lived in Akedah that she wasn't ready for. And now, Chazal, Vayhi achar advarim ha'ela. The connection back to the last story. Where was the offering of the last story? You were so into Yitzchak. And then I said, let Yishmael go. And you said, no, how could I let Yishmael go? He's my heir. And I said, no, he's not going to be your heir. Yitzchak will be your heir. You're so interested in these children, but like, what? Now I'm going to take Yitzchak away from you. Will you let him go? No. Ein na ela lashon bakasha. Why? Because you passed 9 tests. But people might say there was something wrong with one of them. The 9th one. Did you really let him go? So now you plunged Hagar into a situation where she had to witness the near death of her child. And where I'm not sure if you're so willing to let go of a child. And you caused her, because you wouldn't let go of that child, to be in the situation where she wasn't ready to be with him and she made herself far away. There's an Akedah. And in the Akedah, you have to let go of your last heir. And there's no promise there'll be another one. And you have to experience what Hagar experienced. Right? Will you be able to be there for the child at the last moment? Will you be able to give a child back to me and be there with the child, the same situation you put Hagar in? And Avram succeeds with flying colors. It's the tenth test that vindicates the ninth. Have a good week.